Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My guest this week is Royce Young. He's an NBA writer for ESPN based in Oklahoma City. He's covered the Thunder for many years. On top of talking about his work and that team, he and his wife, Carrie, have just a truly remarkable story that they have gone through over the last year or so. It's one you may have seen on Good Morning America or People Magazine. And rather than me sort of intro it at the top here, I will let Royce have the forum. And he's been kind enough to share what's an incredible intimate, or has been an incredible intimate journey for him and his wife, Carrie. So the guest is Royce Young of ESPN.com. Okay, we bring in Royce Young, who I said at the top is an NBA writer for ESPN.com. Covers the Oklahoma City Thunder, and he is based in Oklahoma City, where we talk to him today. Royce Young, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Well, it's an honor, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Royce, you know, as I said to you before, we just popped on the air here. We're just going to go to different places that are so sort of different in just sort of reality and life and what's important and tone. But I do want to start off with a pretty extraordinary thing that that people read about you and your wife, Carrie, and your family. And I want you to sort of explain it more than me, but I'll sort of just try to bring you in people in so that they know at least sort of the larger background. Last December, you and your wife went in for what was sort of like the standard anatomy scan of your child, who at that time was about 19 weeks. That's when you found out that your daughter was diagnosed with a rare birth defect. I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce this right, but anencephalia, is it close?
Yeah, you're in the ballpark. It's anencephaly.
Anencephaly,
good,
all right.
Good try.
Yeah, not the best ballpark there. Yeah. And that's a very rare birth defect, 3 in 10,000 pregnancies rare. So let's start the story there, Royce. At that time, you're planning on, you know, like all of us who have children, you want your child to be healthy. You go in for what's, generally speaking, a relatively, routine procedure, and then you're given this news. What did the doctors tell you and your wife?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a stunning day for us. Like you said, you know, you go into that anatomy scan and, you know, we already have a 2.5-year-old son, so we've been through it before. And, you know, you kind of sit down and, you know, like, okay, we're going to check a lot of different things, you know, check the chambers of the heart and check for cleft palate and check for, you know, make sure the spine is aligned right and all that stuff. And, but, you know, as a parent, you go in with the expectation that it's going to go routine. I mean, why wouldn't you? Even, you know, I'm kind of an anxious person to start with, you know, so you sometimes try to prepare your heart for the worst, but, but the ultrasound tech, you know, she was doing it. And, you know, it's one of those things where in hindsight, you look back on it and you think about how, her tone really did kind of change in the room. You know, they're not allowed to tell us anything. It's the doctor that has to tell us. And, but as she's kind of going over, you know, Carrie and I kind of look back on it. We kind of feel silly now thinking about it, but, you know, we're lighthearted. We're talking about, you know, if it's a boy, you know, or, you know, did we see something there? You know, oh, maybe it is a girl, or is that the umbilical cord? And we're kind of laughing and joking. And meanwhile, you know, this poor ultrasound tech has full awareness that our daughter has a terminal condition, because it's, you know, we didn't know what we were necessarily looking for on an ultrasound, but now that we know what we're looking for, I mean, it's plain as day. You know, we could see it now. But we didn't know it at the time. So, you know, we go through that, and she gets up and she leaves the room for a little bit, and she comes back and she just tells us that your doctor wants to see you guys immediately. And, you know, at that moment, Carrie and I instantly knew that, like, okay, this is super bad news. And, you know, it's kind of, looking back, I think about the things that I said to Carrie. The ultrasound place was in a different building. We had to get in our car and drive across the street to go to see our doctor. And I remember telling Carrie, like, it's going to be okay. Like, you can feel her kick. You know, you're feeling the baby. The baby's alive. The baby's, you know, there's something wrong, but, like, we know the baby's alive. And now, knowing what we know about anencephaly, It was still bad. You know, even like my desperate assurances as a husband trying to like say, it's going to be okay. It was completely wrong. And our doctor, you know, walked in and just immediately told us like, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your baby doesn't have a brain. And obviously it crushed us.
Royce, very shortly thereafter, am I correct that Carrie then asked the doctors, can I still carry our daughter to full term?
Right. Yeah. And she said it and like, something I wrote out and it really resonated with people, but it's, you know, 100% the truth. It was within 30 seconds that she said, if I do this, can we donate her organs? And, I don't know why Carrie thought that, but I guess I do know why, because she's a remarkable human being, but yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it was kind of the type of thing of like, you know, we had the options became pretty clear and present to us instantly about like what we were going to face. And even with Carrie having that on her heart and going to that place pretty quickly, you know, we still went home and for basically 48 hours, like, you know, pros and cons, like what are we going to do? How are we going to handle this? Can we handle the next 20 weeks going forward? One of the things, you know, Richard, as we sat there and considered it, you know, our son was 2.5 and like, okay, so if, you know, what about the time lost here? We want him to be a big brother. Like, you know, we're going to, if we do this for 20 more weeks, you know, how old is he going to be now if it takes us time to get pregnant for another kid? You know, so like we're hashing out all these things in the middle of also trying to, you know, grieve what's, you know, the obvious, which is, you know, the essential loss of a child.
What was for over those 20 weeks, did your wife find joy in the pregnancy? I mean, you understand sort of what ultimately is going to happen, but right. Were there moments that, you know, at least when you feel the baby kick or when you put your ear up to her, her stomach and you might hear stuff. I mean, could you, within the course of what is ultimately, you know, you ultimately know what the resolution is going to be. Do you find moments of joy and excitement or is it all sobering or was it all sobering?
Oh, it was absolutely joyful. And that was one of the things that like, honestly kind of stunned Carrie and I is that, you know, when we kind of made the choice, like, okay, we're going to do this. Part of like our fear was like, you know, how are we going to cope with this over 20 weeks? You know, and we kept seeing it as like, okay, this is going to be a short-term pain of 20 weeks of real dark, you know, difficult times, you know, Carrie feeling the baby kick, Carrie, you know, going to a place and somebody asking her when she's due or if the nursery's ready or somebody making a comment to me and saying, oh, are you ready to have a, you know, are you going to beat the boys off your daughter? You know, how are you going to handle that? And, you know, trying to prepare ourselves for that. We were worried about that sort of thing. And it was the opposite. It we found so much, you know, relief and really it was kind of happiness. And Carrie kind of liked it. She would point it out as, this is not the time to be sad. You know, our daughter is alive in her mama's belly right now. And we need to celebrate that fact. And to be perfectly honest, Richard, like, I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that Carrie and I felt empowered with the fact that we decided to do this. And like we took on the challenge and it was like, we felt like that, you know, this was something that was meaningful. There was a purpose. And so we weren't bitter. It wasn't like we were like, oh, you know, let's grit our teeth and bear it and just kind of like push through this and try to get to the finish line. It was like, no, we're going to do it. And it was like, we were resolute and almost defiant, you know, and I think that that's where a lot of that came from is that we felt immense joy in the fact that like we were going to celebrate this as much as we possibly could.
Royce, how would you characterize how faith-based you and your wife are? And you're certainly welcome if you follow or celebrate a certain religion, feel free to mention it. But I am interested it strikes me that if you are faith-based, like faith would play a serious role in sort of how you approach this.
Yeah, I mean, my wife and I were both Christians. You know, we grew up in church, and I mean, for crying out loud, Richard, we're from Oklahoma. maybe it's assumed at this point. But one of the things that Carrie and I always try to kind of stress to people is that, you know, our faith obviously, you know, played a role in this. I mean, how could it not? But this was not like some religious decision. And I think that a lot of people kind of conflate those two things. But our faith is kind of the foundation of who we are as people. And I think that that's maybe, you know, where we find some of our character or our confidence or whatever it might be in. But, you know, it wasn't like, you know, we had to sit down and like say, you know, like, tell us, God, what are we going to do? Like, I don't think that we necessarily felt that way about it as much as it was just like, okay, this is kind of like, we felt more as if we had been prepared our whole life for this type of moment. And, you know, through a series of life experiences and our faith and our church family and our close friends and all that sort of stuff, it all factored into it. But, you know, yeah, I mean, absolutely, we're faithful people. But I don't think it was, you know, something that we felt like a true conviction from our, you know, from a religion or something like that, as much as it was just like, this is just kind of like, you know, fundamentally who we are as people.
I understand. On April 27th, Royce, you wrote a post for Medium, and this would be the second post that you wrote. The first one, obviously, right. Sort of, I mean, for lack of a better sort of phrase, it went global. I mean, people from...
Right, accidentally.
yeah. I mean, from people from all over the world weighed in, and we'll sort of get to what it's like to have your family story out there for the public. But the title of that piece was, "We Spent Months Bracing and Preparing for the Death of Our Daughter, But Guess What? We Weren't Ready." Can you share with our listeners what that day in particular... or those last days of Eva's life were like for you and Carrie?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that, you know, the plan all along, and I put plan in quotation marks here, was May 2nd, which is yesterday. We're recording this Wednesday, so
right.
It was supposed to be May 2nd. We were going to go in for a C-section with the plan. That was, you know, in an effort to maximize our chances for Eva to be born alive, while also was thereby, you know, as her mom and dad, that we would hopefully get to hold and see her alive, but also to maximize her chances to be eligible for organ donation for transplant. So, you know, we were trying to take every possible step and measure that we could. So, you know, leading up to that, you know, we were just kind of trying to start to mentally prepare ourselves for what was ahead. And kind of like you said, like we were transitioning from maybe the joy and the happiness of the pregnancy to start to, you know, now we're going to start the preparation part of, you know, we know what's next. And, you know, Carrie and I have talked about it. I hate to use the word an advantage that we had, but that's really what it was, is that we had 5 months to kind of prep ourselves. And there's no way that you can prep yourself for it, as I said. But we did have time to grieve this over a long extent. It wasn't like this was a sudden loss. And so we kind of were getting ready. We were figuring out a number of different things. Carrie was planning to walk the Oklahoma City Memorial Marathon. She was going to walk the kids marathon, and she was going to do it like as kind of a, you know, a triumphant mother-daughter thing with Eva and our son Harrison. And that was going to be 3 days before the C-section. So we're like kind of figuring out all these sort of different things. And then Carrie on the Easter Sunday, April 16th, just didn't feel her move. And that's when it like transitioned from this, like, okay, we were somewhat prepared and we were somewhat, you know, we understood the process and the plan, and we met with the organ donation people and the you know, nurses at the hospital and the doctors, and we had all these people involved meeting after meeting after meeting, and all that stuff was out the window all of a sudden. And that was what was, it was all just so sudden. We were prepared not to have a sudden loss, and all of a sudden we had a sudden loss. Mm-hmm. And that was really hard to cope with.
I can't even imagine, to be very honest. The one thing, though, that I know it provides solace for you, and I imagine it certainly has a larger impact than just the singular life, is that you found out, right, that
right.
Eva, you're the eighth family to donate organs of an infant in the state of Oklahoma. Is that right?
Right.
Okay, that's an amazing number. Just that few people, I guess sort of logically it makes sense, but what's going to happen is that Eva is the, let me make sure I'm right about this, the first ever, not just an infant, but the first person in the state of Oklahoma to donate two eyes to for organ procurement. Is that, am I,
yes.
Do I have that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Does that give you and Carrie, if nothing else, the solace of, I understand you wanted all our organs right. to be donated, but there will be a time, or maybe it's already happened already, I don't know enough about organ transplant, where someone is going to see because of your daughter.
Right. And, you know, that's, that's what it was, you know, that Sunday and then the Monday, which we delivered, carried Delivered Eve on Monday. You know, there was a whole lot of things to be disappointed about. And, you know, one, obviously not getting to see my daughter alive absolutely just crushed my soul. But, you know, then there was also the fact of when they came in and they told us that not only would she not be available for as an organ donor for transplant, but not even for research. And that was kind of always this thing of like, so, you know, they kept telling us over and over again, because I'm telling you, Richard, this was like such a fragile thing. They were trying, you know, with the organ transplant doctor, he was based out of Fort Worth, Texas, and like the process and them trying to come up with this protocol and plan. We were the first people to ever try to do infant organ donation out of the this hospital in Oklahoma City.
Wow.
And so like everybody's trying to like figure out like, okay, how are we going to do this and try to come up with like a way to do it. And Carrie and I understood like, you know, this is something that, you know, it just may not work. And, you know, Carrie, before she became a mom, she was a special education teacher. And one of the things she heard in college was this dad came and spoke, and it was always, and he kind of was talking about how, you know, legally, and he would try to get changes made for his son that was special needs. And the son was always like, Dad, by the time you get these things done, you know, I don't even get to take advantage of it. And he said, it's not for you, son. It's for the next person. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how Carrie and I somewhat tried to approach this, is like, we're trying to kind of blaze new trails here a little bit, and we had full understanding it might not work, and we're going to try to be okay with that. So they kept prepping us, like, but if it doesn't work, we can do it for research. Well, when Eva's heart stopped beating, research was out the window. And so, like, it was like, okay, so we didn't even have the plan B, which was, you know, absolutely devastating on top of it all. So when everything happened, I know I'm rambling here. When everything happened and the doctor came in and was able to tell us that Eva was eligible out of nowhere, basically, for eye transplant, it rocked Carrie and I's world. I mean, it was one of the most joyful, incredible experiences in the middle of what was, you know, complete absolute darkness, to be able to kind of have that moment where you're lifted up and you're like, you know, it's not what we always planned and hoped for it to be, but it was something that we desperately needed and we got. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with it. Again, as I just kind of laid out, it's a fragile thing. And, you know, when you're the first to try to do something, it may not work. And we're okay with that. Her eyes may not end up in a recipient and they may just be donated to research. But whatever happens, the people, LifeShare, the organization, were absolutely remarkable and unbelievable in the hard work and effort that they put in to find somebody to get this done. Because there's so many things that we can now see that Eva and her legacy, the connections they made, you know, nobody, like you said, nobody's donated or transplanted an eye from the state of Oklahoma. Now those lines of communication in Oklahoma are opened up to different states. And so when somebody is an organ donor, that can happen now. And so while Eva's eyes may not physically end up in somebody else, we don't know. We'll have to wait and see. No pun intended. You know, but we'll have to wait to find out. Hopefully for that next person, it will be something that can happen.
One of the things I was struck by, Royce, and I'm looking at the post from Medium right now, and I would encourage anyone who's not familiar with Royce's story to either check him out on Facebook, where the initial post came about sort of what he and his wife were going through, and then this post on Medium, which sort of tells you, as Royce explained, what happened on Eva's final days. What was interesting, Royce, to me was that you put photos of you and your wife in some of the most
right.
fragile moments of your life. And I understand that there's probably a part of you that always obviously wanted to remember the moment, and you want that just so you have the memory of it, even though the memory obviously is incredibly painful. What mm-hmm. I was struck by, though, is the fact that you made those public. And,
right.
You know, that it really does sort of change how you read the post. You really feel the pain that you and Carrie were going through. But I'm just curious as to why you made, you know, these are among the more intimate, most personal moments that you will ever have in your life. And you made
right.
those public. Did you and your wife talk about that, and why the decision to do that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I hate to be cliche. You know, I wrote 3,200 words for that Medium post, but those four pictures, you know, they spoke 1,000 words or multiple thousand.
Exactly.
Words, and that's just the way it goes. But yeah, Carrie and I definitely, we talked about what do we want to share some of these pictures? You know, and it was something we decided all along. You know, a close friend of ours is a professional photographer. She's taken all of our family pictures of our son. And, you know, we wanted her to be in the room. And that was always part of the plan for the C-section and everything else, is to get, you know, because these are the memories we're going to have. We're not going to have, you know, pictures of our daughter blowing out a candle on her first birthday, or, you know, at a high school graduation or whatever it is. So we were going to try to, you know, we wanted to make sure that this is the memories that we're going to have, and we need to cherish those. So we wanted a photographer there to do that. And there's, you know, even there's great organizations out there that do this for families that don't have a friend. One's called Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, and they do it free of charge. And it's this wonderful service that they provide. So, I mean, this is something, you know, families in these situations, you know, pretty routinely do. But in terms of, you know, making it public, yeah, that was something Carrie and I had to really kind of consider. And like, but one of the things that we decided early on, especially after my Facebook post inadvertently went public, was that, you know, we want to make sure that we're as authentic and as vulnerable as human beings as we can possibly be in this. There's no reason to try to fake it. And there's no reason to try to pretend that it's either harder than it is or not as harder than it is. And like, this is just real human life. And this is something that two people on the planet went through. And this is what it looked like. And I don't think it's necessarily, you know, I know some people can be cynical about it. They can be like, why would you let people in to see that sort of thing? It's like, because this is what happened to us. And this is what it kind of looked and felt like. I can't let somebody, or I can't force somebody to actually step into my body and know what it felt like that day, but you can at least kind of see it and understand it. And I can write, you know, 3,200 words. I can write 32,000 words. I don't think I could ever describe, you know, as amateur as a writer as I am, to get to the level of to being able to understand it visibly of what it was like. And if, you know, if somebody does sit there and look at those and they think cynically, why would they share that? You know, that's crazy. That's fine. I know that it made Carrie and I feel better to have it out there, for people to kind of be able to look and see and try to kind of maybe feel it a little more tangibly. So of like, this is what it looks like to kind of grieve and feel pain and loss. And it's not a pretty picture, you know, literally.
What was it like when, you know, I'm sort of just like, if you Google your name right now, you know,
right.
People Magazine, Good Morning America, obviously, you know, news organizations all throughout Oklahoma. You know, I think I saw a couple from the UK when, you know, you wrote this, obviously you're a writer, so I imagine part of the writing had to be some sort of catharsis, or,
right.
You know, you were doing it just because you wanted to put down how you were feeling, and obviously your medium is words, so you do that. But what was it like for you to see this start to explode into the public, and then to start getting calls? You know, you're a reporter, you do this for a living.
Right.
You then started getting calls, not just from sports-related places, but from, you know, the places that cover the most famous people on the planet. Was it surreal? Was it, I shouldn't even guess. What was it like?
Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly honest, Richard, it was embarrassing. I mean, that's how I felt. I felt that I was like, oh my gosh, I'm exposed. You know, like, first of all, like, you know, I was completely terrified that people were going to have the wrong perception of it, that it was like this, you know, attention grab here. And like, you know, like one thing I felt like every person that I would see, like even complete strangers that would say something to me, I felt like I had to like preface it and be like, I put it on my personal Facebook page. I didn't mean for it to get out there. Like I was just basically trying to impress my in-laws, you know, like make my wife feel good. And, you know, like I felt like I had to like try to kind of, you know, make people understand that, you know, that, you know, I wasn't after that. It was just kind of this organic thing that sort of happened. But then you see how it resonated with people and the impact that it had. And you get messages, like you said, from around the world. You know, somebody sent me a picture of it in a newspaper in South Africa and New Zealand. And like people sending you messages saying that they signed up to be an organ donor because they saw it. Like that stuff is really powerful. And like cynicism be damned. Like, I don't care. Like at that point, like, you know, forget it. If that's the kind of impact that it's having on people, then that's great. And but it was certainly weird to be on the other side of it. And you know, we got you know, honestly, we got a ton of media requests, and we're still getting them. And Carrie and I, you know, tried to kind of be deliberate and very choosy with what we wanted to do, because we didn't want it to seem like this media tour. Like, you know, these people, we wanted it to be, you know, authentic and well understood. And so we kind of decided to do one thing, and it was like, we'll do the Good Morning America thing. Like, that's, you know, that's something to do. Like, that's a good place to tell the story to some degree. And, like, you know, people are interested, they're curious about what's happening here, and, like, let's do it that way. And, you know, that's the only real, you know, kind of official, you know, I think I talked with somebody for CNN for a quick quote or two, and maybe somewhere else, like send a couple emails back to a couple people to explain or clarify a few things. But, like, it just felt to me like let's not let anybody try to divert from what hopefully the real message is here, which is, you know, hopefully about, you know, optimism and life and doing something for other people that you would hope somebody would do for you. So, but it was, you know, to be on the other side of it, yeah, I'm the guy typically asking for an interview here, and I'm annoyed when somebody turns me down. So here I am, like, you know, turning everybody down that's sending me messages. You know, that's just the way it had to go.
How's Carrie's health at the moment, post delivery?
You know, that's, you know, again, if we're looking for bright sides here, that it's amazing how well she's doing physically. And, you know, she didn't have a C-section with our firstborn. So this was kind of a scary thing for her, was that this planned C-section. And to be perfectly honest, she was freaked out about it. And we were both worried. And because of complications within Eva's condition, Carrie was measuring, she had this fluid issue in her, you know, essentially she was measuring at 42 weeks when she was 36 weeks pregnant. So her stomach was way bigger. And so there was some concern from the doctors in the C-section that she might lose her uterus. Like, it was not a significant concern, but it was enough of a concern for them to bring it up to us. But, you know, with the way that this ended up happening, she delivered Eva vaginally, and, you know, her recovery has been just amazing. And, you know, that's one of the real true blessings that we've experienced, is that this had, you know, on top of grieving the loss of a child, Carrie physically feels pretty good. Now, one of the downsides that did happen is, you know, as nature, is her milk, you know, tried to come in, and that was something that was kind of painful, both physically and emotionally, is to stop your milk from coming in.
Right.
Because that's kind of just a reminder of, like, you know, your body's telling you that you're supposed to have a baby to give this to, but instead you're not doing it. And that was something, but that's kind of over with a little bit. And so she's doing a lot better now.
Yeah, man, that part is rough. How did basketball help with all this, if at all? Did it provide moments of, at least for you, moments to sort of maybe not think about Eva and to just focus on your job? I'm sort of in this interview answering too many of my questions. I'll just ask it straight.
Yeah.
How did basketball help you, if it helped you at all?
It helped a ton. I mean, first of all, I love my job. I mean, I'm immeasurably blessed to do a job that I absolutely adore. And, you know, this season that I was up close and personal to was a historic one. With, you know, I was at it basically every game Russell Westbrook played this year. You know, he averages a triple-double and breaks Oscar Robertson's record. And so, you know, for me, you know, I remember one specific day, Carrie and I met with the organ donation people, and they had kind of some bad news for us about one of the things that the organ transplant doctor wanted to do that was really upsetting to Carrie and I, that we were having a hard time coping with. And so, you know, we drive home from that meeting, and I, you know, we're upset and crying, and it's really difficult, and come home basically and say goodbye, and I head off to the arena for a game that night, you know, and, like, because, you know, I still got my job and I still got to do it. And then you go to the arena, though, and you see Russell Westbrook put up 40 points, 12 rebounds, and 13 assists or something, and you see something amazing. And, you know, it does kind of, it crystallized it for me. And I've grown up around sports my whole life. I love sports. But you do get a full understanding of how sports can just kind of release you from your everyday life. And it's not that it was like I was able to forget it. It wasn't like it was something that where, oh, okay, I'm free of having to think about this for 2 hours. But it does just kind of make you enjoy something and appreciate something else. And, you know, I know Russell Westbrook wasn't out there, you know, putting up triple doubles for me personally, but sometimes it kind of felt that way. You know, like, it was like, you know, to show up to the arena and, you know, watch a guy do something amazing was, you know, an incredible, you know, experience. And, you know, to be perfectly blunt, it was great for my career too. I'm on TV more. I'm, you know, writing stories that are up close and up front and visible to everybody. People care about the story. They're into what Russell Westbrook's doing. And, you know, it was a way for me to kind of compartmentalize life. And so, I mean, it was, as much as anything else, you know, writing is therapeutic for me, whether it's something about what I'm doing personally or something I'm watching. If I've got something I'm thinking, I want to write it down. So yeah, watching, covering basketball this year was a huge part of that.
How much did the Thunder organization, the Thunder players, know about what was going on with you away from your job?
They knew about it, and they were awesome to me, and a lot of them, you know, kind of gave me space. I'm close with a lot of people within the organization, front office people. We actually had a benefit like dinner that some of the people, like some of the wives of Thunder staff, put on. My wife has kind of gotten to know a few of them, and they threw us this benefit dinner because, you know, we're paying double hospital bills and having ultrasounds every week, and it was kind of starting to pile up a little bit. And they threw us this benefit dinner, and you know who shows up at it but Billy Donovan. And it was just this incredible gesture from Billy, and Billy's a great guy, and it's been told before, but him and his wife had a stillborn baby 2 days away from their due date a number of years ago. So this is something he kind of could personally relate to, and Billy was fantastic and still is fantastic of just kind of talking to me on a personal level. And that's one of those things that I think, Richard, a lot of people don't quite comprehend when they kind of consume sports media, is that these are relationships that you have. And as a reporter, I think that we all understand as professionals that we can differentiate between the job and also connecting with people on a human level. And I can sit there and I can tell you that Billy Donovan's making really dumb decisions about who he's playing a backup point guard, while also saying that he's a wonderful man and he's a great human being. So, people within the Thunder were great. You know, after the season was over, or close to the end of the season, Steven Adams pulled me aside and said some really nice things to me about it. And he actually donated some shoes to that benefit dinner, wow, some autographed shoes. Russell Westbrook, after the season was over, said some really nice things to me about it. And, Russell's a really private guy, and he kind of even said to me, I'm really private. I don't know if you were the same way, so I didn't want to ever bring it up. But they were all, unbelievably kind people about this whole thing.
You graduated from the University of Oklahoma, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, sir.
And fairly quickly after that, you got a job with the True Hoop Group. Am I sort of right on the bio, or am I missing some parts?
I majored in journalism at OU, and my official job out of college was working in marketing at OU. And then, but within that, I got connected with the True Hoop Network. It wasn't necessarily quote unquote a job, but it was kind of my path into what I was hoping to turn into a career at some point.
Okay. And then in terms of full-time coverage of the Thunder, is it the first year that they're in Oklahoma City after leaving Seattle?
Well, yeah. So I started a blog that was connected to the True Hoop Network, and I started it literally the day that they chose the team's name.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
So I started writing about them that day, and but all the while having a full time job because I just got married. Carrie and I got married my last semester at OU, and then my first actual job is I got hired by CBSSports.com to kind of be an NBA blogger for them, while also still kind of maintaining the blog. And then ESPN hired me later on down the line.
Gotcha. Okay, how does being an Oklahoman shape your coverage of the Thunder? If it shapes
it
at all.
That's a great question, because it is a little awkward at times because, Oklahoma is an incredibly prideful place. It's a very, tight-knit community. When the team relocated from Seattle to Oklahoma City, a lot of people here in Oklahoma viewed supporting the Thunder as the civic duty, and I was part of that too. I felt like I was part of that. And, I think, but it's all kind of been part of the, my personal maturation and evolution as, a professional, to be able to kind of start to grow and understand how to differentiate between those different things. But it does make it a little bit more personal at times. When you see last summer, for example, when Kevin Durant decides to leave Oklahoma City and go to the Golden State Warriors, as an Oklahoman, it kind of hits me personally because, you see what a guy like Kevin Durant meant to Oklahoma City in terms on a global scale, the pride that people would feel seeing people in London or Madrid or Tokyo or wherever wearing a Kevin Durant number 35 jersey that said Oklahoma City on it. And, Oklahomans have this kind of little man syndrome. There's no doubt about it. They are very, very sensitive to the idea that it's, small town, tumbleweed rolling through the streets, all the perceptions, do they even have internet in that state type of stuff. And then, you know, Kevin Durant up and leaves, and it kind of validates a lot of that. He not only leaves, you know, Oklahoma City, but he leaves to go to San Francisco. It's like grapes of wrath, you know. he leaves, and he takes off, and he goes west. And, you know, I think that, so like me personally, I felt like I connected to some of that stuff, and it kind of resonated with me a little bit differently. And I think that that's, honestly, Richard, I think it's kind of one of the challenges of the job. Is to, while at the same time, I think intimately I understand maybe a little bit of the connection the team has with the state and the city, but I do think that sometimes I have to try to separate that to make sure that that doesn't really kind of cloud what I'm and let that emotionally impact me.
All right, I'm going to mix in some of the questions that I got from listeners in between sort of what I have for you. And one of the things that came up, and again, this is not 500 people asking it, but it's a couple, and I think it's fair to ask you. There are people who say there is a perception, at least among some NBA readers and fans, that you are apt to more defend the Thunder, particularly, right. I guess, more defend Russell Westbrook, and their reasoning for that, rightly or wrongly, is because you are an Oklahoman. And I wonder if you want to address what if you hear from people maybe outside of Oklahoma who believe that you are too much a defender of either players or the organization because of where you were born.
Yeah. Am I a homer? Yeah. That's what everybody wants to know.
Right.
Am I a homer? You know, I'm actually thrilled that this got brought up because, I mean, this is a tough topic for a lot of people to understand. And, you know, one of my things that I always tried to approach the job with is to be as possibly fair as as I can be. Just try to be fair. And I think sometimes what people perceive as defending or going to bat for somebody is really just trying to kind of be somewhat objective. Because, you know, I think in this world, Richard, as you obviously know, you know, people will either say you're a homer or you're a hater. And, you know, you're going to kind of get painted into one corner or the other. And if you go overly negative and you criticize Russell Westbrook for every single turnover that he has, well, now you're just a hater that doesn't recognize the fact that he's put together this historical season and triple doubles and what he's meant to the city and to the state and the organization and re-signing after Durant leaves. Or if you try to praise him and you recognize the fact that he's done something incredible, now you're ignoring the fact of, you know, Russell Westbrook's wild and they can't win with him or whatever it may be. So, you know, I try to be as emotionally disconnected from as I can be, because, you know, fans are emotionally invested in these teams, and I think a lot of times they project their own personal opinion, and if you don't fit theirs, then all of a sudden they paint you into one of those corners. You're the homer or you're the hater. So, you know, whether or not people think that I'm a, you know, overly defender of the Thunder, that's fine with me. I think one of the answers that I often give to people is, I don't know what you necessarily expect me to say. You know, we're talking about one of the most successful franchises in all of professional sports over the last 8 years. There's not a lot of negative things to say about them. And I think that some people will look at, you know, something that you write, and there's plenty of stories. You know, people can go through my archives at ESPN, and there's plenty of stories in there that have been highly critical of Russell Westbrook and the way that he played a game, or the, you know, six turnovers that he had in the fourth quarter. But people don't tend to remember that sort of thing when they've already kind of built their own personal narrative about you. You know, they will only remember a tweet that you had that said that he averaged this many points against James Harden or whatever it is. So I can't help that sort of thing. I can only try to do my job as I best possibly can and hope that the work kind of just speaks for itself.
Right. Well, I think we've all been on the side of a couple people cherry picking tweets and then writing a narrative around you. I imagine maybe I've done it myself to others too. So I get that. I try not to, but
it's part of it. It's part of it. I mean, and it's something I get, and, you know, it's like one of those things, Richard. I think that sometimes I sit there and I'm like, okay, I'm going to rack my brain and come up with this like really critical angle. Like, I'm going to come up with like a negative thing against the team. And then I'm like, well, that's not fair either. Like, if I'm just trying to do it just for the sake of it, just to, like, you know, fluff up some fake credibility to prove that I'm not some kind of, you know, defender of the team. Like, to me, I just try to approach it as being as fair as I possibly can. And, you know, how people want to perceive that is just kind of up to them.
I remember the piece you did last July, which was a really long takeout on the changes that led to Kevin Durant's departure from Oklahoma City. I thought it was really well done. But I would imagine that depending on how you viewed Kevin Durant leaving, you might sort of then view your piece a certain way. Did you find that those who believed Durant had the right to sort of, you know, look, ultimately wants to win a championship, he has absolutely the right as a free agent to head to Golden State because he believes it's a better chance, versus obviously those who believe that, you know, Oklahoma City did everything they could for the guy and he ends up leaving. Did you find that people were reacting to your piece based on their own lens on Durant?
I think that that's probably fair to say. And, you know, the one thing that, you know, some people have been kind of critical of that story.
Right.
And the thing that I tell a lot of people about it is like, look, that story didn't really contain any opinion to it. That story was a reported story that essentially was done over 8 years of knowing Kevin Durant very personally, knowing Kevin Durant's people, knowing his parents, knowing his brother, knowing his agent, you know, knowing people within the Thunder organization, knowing shoe people. I mean, like, so what people can perceive to be some sort of thing that I have shaded or done, a lot of that story was Kevin Durant's own words that he said both publicly and privately. And, you know, as a reporter, you just can report the story that's in front of you and use what's available to you, factual information. And, you know, I felt like that I looked back on that story and I felt like I was completely fair as I could be because it was just the information that was at hand. And so, you know, whether somebody wanted to say that, well, you were, you know, shading it one way or the other, that's fine. I didn't, in that story, especially in anything after, I didn't blame Kevin Durant for leaving at all. I just tried to explain why he left. And, it, you know, obviously it was within his right to leave. But, you know, this is the reason why. This is the reason a guy that said that he wanted his jersey retired in Oklahoma City, or a guy that told Russell Westbrook that he loved him, or a guy that, you know, publicly said during his MVP speech that the grass isn't greener in another city. Like, why did that guy leave? Why did that guy leave Oklahoma City after spending 7 years of telling everyone how much he wanted to stay? And so I felt like, you know, I had enough information to kind of try to tell that story. Now, I know a lot of people, you know, have picked out, and it's one of the more frustrating things, they picked out like a single line in it. The fact that I mentioned, you know, Kevin Durant had a failed engagement, and they've used that to say that I took some sort of personal shot at him. You know, and the one regret that I do have is that I didn't link to the fact that Durant himself said that it publicly in an interview with GQ. That's what that was from.
Right.
That he said it. He's the one that said that he was impulsive and proposed to his girlfriend at that time. And so I saw it as just a list of, like, these are examples of him making impulsive type decisions, because everybody that was around him knows, and people that are still around him know, that that's kind of his tendency, is to kind of make decisions off the cuff. And that was just an example of it. But, you know, I can't kind of help that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate you you're referring back to that. All right, a couple more here. There was a piece, certainly well-read within sports media circles, that Brian Curtis wrote in 2015 for Grantland on the relationship between the Oklahoma City Thunder media and Thunder players and management. And it was, you know, very clear. Certainly there was tension in the locker room, particularly between Russell Westbrook, Kevin Durant, and a couple of, or maybe one in particular, columnist from the Oklahoman. And it just sort of, I mean, tell me if I'm mischaracterizing it here. It sort of like amplified the dysfunction, at least at that time, between the relationship between maybe the players, the PR staff of the Thunder, and the people who cover the team every day. One, what was your sort of take on that piece? And two, have things changed from then?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Brian wrote a great piece, and, you know, he interviewed me as part of it. And, you know, part of it, I think what he was trying to kind of solve is, like, you know, Kevin Durant was kind of popping off, and he was, you know, it was clear that he was kind of getting frustrated, and, you know, he was taking it out some on the media in Oklahoma City, and then Russell Westbrook had his thing, and so Brian kind of came in of like, okay, so what's the deal here? And yeah, I think that in a lot of ways, you know, some of the things within that were very fair. You know, the Thunder, to their credit, have used that, and they have changed a lot of their policies. They did like a very introspective look. They talked to a lot of people around Oklahoma City, media members, and they said, okay, so how can we do this better if this is the way you guys feel? Because I think that, you know, the Thunder themselves were a little bit embarrassed by it, and they kind of said, okay, we need to change our policies if this is the way it's going to be. So I personally think that they've done a really good job with it. Now, I will say this about the piece. I didn't necessarily agree with a lot of the things that some of the reporters in Oklahoma City said, because they ended up kind of taking the viewpoint of that the Thunder PR staff has built up a wall between being able to get to know players. And as a reporter, Richard, I never had that problem, really. And I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, but it's like, that's my job as a reporter. I got to break down the walls myself. I got to build relationships. It's not the PR staff's job necessarily to arrange a lunch with Nick Collison for me. You know, like, I got to build that relationship on my own. And so some of the kind of grievances that some of the reporters aired, I didn't really necessarily relate to because these weren't really things that, I had too much of an issue with.
All right, a couple more here, Royce, and then I'm going to let you go. Russell Westbrook, obviously, is if he's not the MVP this year, he's an MVP caliber player every year.
Right.
He's someone who doesn't just draw interest locally, but will be a national figure. ESPN, Beyond You will write about him or air him, Sports Illustrated, New York Times, et cetera. So this is a guy there's a lot of interest in given just his remarkable ability. He's also not a guy who necessarily is, I hope I'm not mischaracterizing him, but he's fairly private and he's not going to be somebody who's always going to, he's not the guy who wants, he's not Charles Barkley. He's not inviting the press into his house every day. So what is your, you've now obviously been covering him for multiple years. What is, how would you evaluate your professional relationship with him? And has it been something that you've had to work on, given that he is not somebody who's naturally going to gravitate to the press?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly something you got to work on. One of the things, you know, I've known Russell for almost now a decade, and one of the things that anybody that's around him for any extended period of time is that if you can just learn to just, if you can somehow learn and figure out a way to build his trust and then understand not to betray it, you're good with Russell Westbrook, and you can, he'll forgive you if, as long as you tell him, hey, like, that was my bad about something. Or, but if, you know, if you try to kind of challenge the guy and you try to push him and you try to burn him, he doesn't let it go. And I think we've all kind of gotten a taste of that and seen how the fallout's happened with his relationship with Kevin Durant, is that if he feels like he's been betrayed, he's not going to let it go. There's been times that he's frozen out reporters, Richard, that he felt like asked him a bad question. And he just won't answer their question now for the next 3 months, because that's his signal to you to say, like, you got to come up and tell me that you're sorry. And that's just the way that Russell kind of is. But, you know, for me, I think, you know, I've had the advantage of knowing the guy for a long time. He's kind of seen me grow up in the business. And, you know, I've seen him kind of grow up as a player. You know, he's an expectant father here any day. And, you know, I think that for him, this season was a big time learning process, because, you know, he used to be able to kind of hide behind Kevin Durant. And, you know, while Westbrook was obviously a megastar in his own right, Durant was the face of the franchise. And he, you know, Durant is an excellent interview and a very introspective, thoughtful guy.
Right.
And, you know, great quotes and great relationship with the media. You know, Kevin, if you said, Kevin, can I get you for a minute after the game, Kevin would drop everything and step over to the side and give you five more minutes with him. I mean, Kevin's just a wonderful guy like that. So Russell's not doing that type of stuff necessarily with the media, but he is making an effort, I will say. He is trying to do more things. Like last two seasons ago, he didn't do a single one-on-one interview. It didn't matter who asked. It could have been Oprah Winfrey. It didn't matter who was asking for a one-on-one interview. Russell Westbrook was not going to do it. This year, he probably did 10 of them. And I think that he kind of understood, on the one hand, his role and responsibility as kind of the franchise guy now. And on the other hand, he wanted to win MVP. And that's a way to do it, is to get yourself out there, start doing some interviews. And if, you know, if you want to build up your brand a little bit, you got to break down and you got to understand the media is part of that.
I want to see the Russell Westbrook from 2 years ago actually turn down Oprah. That'd be incredible, actually. No one turns down Oprah.
He might have. I don't know.
Here are the final two. And again, these were questions given by listeners for you. They're specific, sort of Oklahoma City specific. The sports media industry has a lot of people who move to jobs in bigger cities, and there's no doubt that national places value people in big markets. You've managed to stay be in Oklahoma City now for a long time and work for a national place. Do you feel that there's a obviously, we're doing this interview after one of the worst weeks in the history of your company in terms of so many talented people being laid off. But you're in a unique position in that you're a national NBA writer, but you're located in a small market, and the small market teams don't always traditionally, they're not always great, or they haven't been as great as the Thunder have. So how do you look at your own future within that kind of that landscape? You know, you were, when Durant was there, you know, you're sort of covering essentially the glamour team of the league, or one of the top three teams, you know, LeBron and Golden State. Now it's a good team, obviously, Royce, you know that, but it's no longer one of the glamour teams in the league. Do you worry at all that that the market dries up for Oklahoma City news?
Of course you got to worry. I mean, yeah, I think that that's just, you know, being a reasonable, common sense type of person is that, especially in the NBA, it's a star-driven league, and ESPN likes stars. Russell Westbrook moves the needle as much as any player in the league. You know, I think that, you know, Russell, in terms of an individual, may have been the biggest individual story in the NBA this year.
Definitely.
And that was great for me. You know, that was great for me. And, you know, I'm in full awareness of that. You know, I told people, I think I said it on SportsCenter after Durant left, that I am not ashamed to say that Kevin Durant built my career. I would not work at ESPN if it weren't for Kevin Durant. You know, Kevin Durant's stardom is what helped put a spotlight on me. And, you know, I'm incredibly grateful, you know, not that he did it for me, but, like, you know, I mean, I am appreciative of the guy, that I would not have ever had an opportunity to do anything maybe in this business without a guy like that, and him and Russell. So, I'm in full understanding and awareness of that, but to me, that's one of the incredible things about a place like ESPN is that if you're willing to put your head down and you're willing to go to work, you can find a lot of different ways to grow and evolve yourself. And, you know, whether that's, you know, maybe covering Russell Westbrook for the rest of his career, I don't know. But, you know, I think that ESPN will afford you plenty of opportunity to try different things, to learn different things, to try to build your skill set. And it's up to me at that point to show them that I'm valuable and that I'm versatile and I can do different things and I can, you know, I can be on TV. I could do radio for you. I could try to write longer form features or whatever. And that's my responsibility to do it. I can't just sit here and rely on Russell Westbrook to keep signing contracts and, you know, keep me relevant. I've got an incredible opportunity at ESPN and I've got to take advantage of it.
All right. Here's the last one. And this is I said we'd leave it to the end. Very specific Thunder related. You obviously have Westbrook at point guard, so you have one of the best, you know, one of the three or four best players to sort of build around. Then the team itself, it's interesting to see where they're headed in the future. And I got a lot of questions for you about whether Enes Kanter would be moved and then what Oklahoma City might be looking for in the draft. So you can take that however you want. Where do they need to build in terms of the draft, and do you think they are looking to deal anybody to get different assets?
Yeah, I mean, they got a big time summer of uncertainty ahead of them. There's no question about it. They, you know, are in a new world here where they're trying to build a roster around Russell Westbrook as a solitary superstar. You know, Sam Presti and his front office kind of meticulously planned to try to build a roster to complement Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook as a tandem heading into the primes of their careers, which is what the Thunder kind of almost kicked their feet up on their desk and put their hands behind their back and felt like they had ready after they made a trade on draft night last year acquiring Victor Oladipo. They felt like you get Kevin Durant to re-sign, you got Russell Westbrook, they're heading into the primes of their career. The Thunder felt like they were going to get Al Horford in free agency. They felt like it was almost a done deal if they could just get Kevin Durant to come back. And they thought that they were going to have their best team yet. Obviously, that, you know, best laid plans didn't really work out, as I know personally. Plans don't always work out.
Right.
The Thunder then kind of had to transition into, okay, now let's learn and see what happens with a Russell Westbrook-led team. And that's a lot of what this season was about, is kind of evaluating, building some evidence, some data, some information about what does a team look like that plays around Russell Westbrook. And within that, their number one priority is to re-sign him to an extension this summer. If they don't get that done, to be perfectly honest, Richard, they're going to have to look at trading him, and which is, you know, one of the most, you know, stunning things to think about is the guy that wins MVP might be on the trade block later that year. But the expectation is from everybody that I know that Westbrook is going to sign that extension with the Thunder. And then from there, then you build it out. Then, you look to maybe flip a piece like Enes Kanter. You try to find shooters that you can space the floor with Westbrook with. You try to move pieces around. Westbrook is about to turn 29 years old. The window here isn't that lengthy for the Thunder to capitalize on a transcendent level player. So they got to get to work and they got to figure out a roster that's going to complement him.
I know there's so many reasons why you really can't think like this, given the salary cap, et cetera, et cetera. But do you ever close your eyes and just like potentially imagine for a moment Harden, Westbrook, and Durant all playing together this year and you'd be covering that team?
If you don't think about that at least once a day when I wake up, then I would be crazy. How could you not think about that every day? I mean, think about Harden, Westbrook, Durant, Ibaka. That was always the plan. I mean, that was always the plan for Sam Presti. But like I've joked with him about before, is he did too good of a job. He drafted too many good players. You know, if you do a little bit worse in the draft, you could have maybe kept some of these guys. But Yeah, I mean that would be that'd be some kind of team.
Yeah, if you're listening from Oklahoma, I apologize. I'm not trying to rub it down your face.
You just ripped off a big old. You just opened up.
Of those like fantasy things where you're just like, oh my god, I wish they could play together for like you know.
It might be the greatest. I mean, I don't know if it's the greatest NBA what if, but it's probably got to be in the top five, right?
It's got to be up there. You'd have to, you know, maybe you go back to, or you just sort of you make up like you know what if. Bird and Magic played together, or you know, what if
right.
Jordan, whoever. But the thing is, like, these guys could have. That's the difference.
They were actually on the same team.
Right.
They were on the same team.
Yeah. The other what ifs are a little trickier because you're sort of creating something that that didn't happen, but that's gonna be one of the great what ifs.
Yeah.
Royce Young is an NBA writer for ESPN.com. He's based in Oklahoma City, covers the Thunder. You can follow his work on ESPN.com. You also see him on television, obviously, when the Thunder is in the news, and that happens a lot with Russell Westbrook. He also shared the story of what he and his wife, Carrie, sort of went through over the last year. And it was clearly tough for them, but it's going to be one that it really is going to have an impact and I think help a lot of people heading forward in terms of just especially those who go through something similar to know that they're not alone. Royce, I really appreciate you doing this. These are not easy topics that you spoke about, but when we talked prior, though, you did say that it does sometimes help in terms of the catharsis and the therapy to talk about this stuff. So I really do appreciate you sharing. 100%. I really do appreciate you sharing this with those at least who listen to this podcast. And thank you very much for joining us today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
You bet, Richard. I appreciate you having me on. Like you said, it's therapeutic for me to sit down and write, and you know it feels good to talk about my little girl, even though she's not with me. But to think about that, I can speak her name, and she can continue to have a legacy, makes me and my wife pretty happy. So, really appreciate you having me on.
All right, back in the studio to wrap up very quick. My thanks to Royce Young for his honesty and his time. Lou Pellegrino is the producer of this podcast. I appreciate his work on this. Previous podcast that we've done prior to this, James Andrew Miller on the ESPN layoffs, Amy Trask, and Caitlin Thompson. Amy Trask, an NFL analyst for CBS. Caitlin Thompson is the publisher of Racket. And Kevin Harlan, the fine play-by-play voice for Turner Sports, as well as the Westwood One for Monday Night Football. So please check those previous episodes out if interested. My thanks to the Digital Media Group for their production skills here. Thank you to those at Sports Illustrated. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.